We will first hear from Cleo Plavantis, who is a chaplain. She received her Master of Divinity degree from St. Vladimir's and is currently a chaplain at the Breast Service Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Following her, we will hear from Sister Rebecca Cowan from Newskeet Monastery, who is a certified spiritual counselor and director, amongst her many other talents, but will give us an insider's view of that particular ministry. Next, we will hear from Dr. Susan Ashbrook Harvey, who is a tantra chanter at St. Mary Antiochian Orthodox Church. She's also a professor at Brown University, specializes in Syriac studies, early Christian history, the Christianity and Byzantine and Syriac traditions, and with particular respect to women. And she will be speaking on what we've termed the ministry of the word. The word is in its small and big W versions, as reader, chanter, and homilist. And last, we will hear from our friend Anne Marie Massera, who was basically the lay vice chair for nearly 20 years, to speak about from an administrative perspective and what we can kind of the diaconal ministry from that. And Karen will be our timekeeper. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Cleo. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Before I begin, I would like anybody who's here who has done a unit of CPE, who has attended seminary, to stand up, please. Thank you. So I just want you to know I'm not a unicorn. So, I am honored to be speaking to you today, and I hope that what I'm about to say will move all of you to find your own particular ministry or deepen the ministry you already perform within the Orthodox Church. My talk is fairly straightforward. I will outline what chaplains do in hospitals, I will talk about the training involved, and I'll tell you about some of the visits I've made as a chaplain, and who my role models were for chaplaincy, and how I feel that chaplains serve the Orthodox Church. So first of all, what chaplains do. Chaplains are trained listeners. The bulk of what they do is to be present for the experience of the person in front of them. It's extremely important, particularly in this day and age of electronic media and virtual communication. I can't stress that enough. Chaplains, the conversations that chaplains have often address spiritual distress, including its emotional and psychological aspects. The chaplain may be speaking to, and this is important, the chaplain may be speaking to a patient, a doctor, a nurse, tech, food service worker, environmental service technician, therapist, or security personnel. You are never off duty. You never have a coffee break. And sometimes, given the way commuting is in New York City, from the moment you step out your door, you are on as chaplain. Chaplains move throughout the entire hospital, and everyone in the hospital is a member of your congregation, whether or not they choose to avail themselves of your services. And I quote the Reverend Johnny C. Bush, CPE supervisor. These visits may center on theology, family concerns, fears of imminent death, remorse for acts committed decades before the discussion, or concerns about hospital protocol. The conversations stem from the loss and change that are part of everyday life, but are accentuated by hospital stays. Spiritual distress is an opportunity to grow in faith, and chaplains serve in hospitals to help their congregations find their own spiritual core and establish a strong and secure connection to their own spirituality. This is what one-to-one visits are all about. They may or may not be opportunities for prayer and contemplation. Chaplains often hear confessions and guide patients through confession. And here I am separating confession from the rite of absolution. However, it's my personal feeling that the core work of absolution takes place in that preliminary confession and discussion and advisement from clergy. Very important, that one-to-one, face-to-face personal connection. From information gained in the visit, a chaplain makes a spiritual assessment and a plan for care for each patient. And this is entirely confidential and comes under hospital privacy guidelines. This plan for care and assessment enters into the patient's electronic medical record. Chaplains also run spirituality groups serving many patient populations, such as substance abuse and recovery, mental health, dementia, cancer, and bereavement. Chaplains are mandated members of palliative care teams and hospice care teams. Chaplains sit on ethics committees within hospitals, consult regularly with all medical staff about patients and their care, visit pastorally with staff and other administration as needed, open and close meetings and community observance, and lead community worship during religious holidays, as well as memorial services and weekly worship services. I want to point out that the worship you lead in the hospital is generic. It is for all people of faith. Chaplains are expected to visit their patients and staff of all religions and nationalities and sexual orientation. Every person in the hospital is a member of a chaplain's parish and is entitled to all spiritual care the chaplain can provide. If this sounds like a big job to you, it is. It's also exciting and rewarding. Hospital chaplaincy, along with collegiate chaplaincy or corporate chaplaincy, is a vocation in and of itself. Each of those chaplaincies has its own challenges and requirements, and you would do well to let it choose you rather than you choosing it. How do you become a chaplain? Training for chaplaincy is a long process. These days, training begins at seminary with an MA or MDiv degree and takes anywhere from 3 years on, depending on your family obligations. I encourage anyone who is interested in chaplaincy to pursue an MDiv degree. There are often demands to lead worship, and it is helpful to have had the chance to put together your own services before you work under the more immediate and demanding deadlines of a hospital. Wrestling with the intricacies of Orthodox Great Vespers is an invaluable experience for a hospital chaplain. Yes, you know what I'm talking about. A straightforward, generic Christmas Day service fairly rolls off the keyboard in comparison. Orthodox worship, with its structured litanies, is a great pattern for putting together a coherent worship service with a clear message. Homiletics is also vital, as chaplains are often asked to give weekly sermons. The other half of chaplaincy training is clinical pastoral education, or CPE. I'm going to try to give us somewhat of an overview of this so that you don't get bogged down in technicalities. But all the people who have been here and I can talk to you about the specifics of this. Clinical pastoral education. A 4-unit minimum is required for board certification, but you can be hired without being board certified, but you need to have 4 units. Each unit is roughly 400 hours of training, comprised of visits with patients, formal seminars, electronic charting, and attending hospital meetings as needed. You can do what's called a consultation and assessment after your first unit, which gets you into the second level of CPE. This is getting more involved. But what I like to say is that reflection and self-evaluation are at the core of clinical pastoral education. It is the only thing I know of that truly develops pastorality. Seminary education doesn't seem to do it as much as clinical pastoral education. And just a sidelight, my last supervisor told me that clinical pastoral education actually started out as just pastoral education. Seminaries were not able to incorporate it into their curriculum, and so it went into the hospitals where they were open to having it and hosting it. So it became clinical pastoral education. Another key element of CPE is that there's a lot of self-evaluation and evaluation of your peers. So you receive a lot of evaluation. If there are five members in your CPE group, you're evaluated five times, and you're also evaluated by your supervisor. You get a lot of information. Students can be hired as staff after four units. Provisional certification can be granted on completion of four units and a review of a student's work by a board of chaplains. Full certification requires at least four units of CPE and a further 2,000 hours of paid work, voluntary work, or internship as a chaplain. Board certification is recognized throughout the US and Europe. A final word about training: keep all your evaluations and certificates, document everything. In order to go before a certificate board, a CPE student needs to have recommendations and to be endorsed by her home denomination. She may also be commissioned, but neither commission, and this is very important, neither commission nor ordination is a requirement for chaplaincy. I want to say that again. Neither commission nor ordination is a requirement for chaplaincy. At this time, to my knowledge, the Greek Orthodox Church of America and the Orthodox Church of America have officially endorsed women for as women MDivs to be chaplains. I also have with me today an announcement that came out from the Synod in 2012 about an official statement that ordination is not necessary for chaplaincy. Being a hospital chaplain is about being present in the moment and trusting that whatever is happening is an opportunity for the patient to find their way to God. Out of that hospital journey, patients discover their spiritual core. It is who I am as an Orthodox woman that fuels my chaplaincy and allows me to guide my patients. I can only speak out of my own experience of Orthodoxy, but that experience has the ability to speak to others of all different faiths. My role models for chaplaincy. That brings me to the role models for my chaplaincy: Mother Maria of Paris and Mother Gavrilia. Sorry. They're my role models because their lives share some circumstances with my own. They were both in the middle of their lives when they began trying to do God's work. Mother Maria had been married twice and lost a young daughter to illness. Mother Gavrilia had been a physical therapist, I'd been a dancer, and stayed home to take care of her mother. When both of these women did their work, they had no grants, no insurance, sometimes no passport, and certainly not much recognition to start out with. They basically stepped out on their faith and conviction that the work was worthwhile. Orthodox women are still doing that, and they must continue. What do Orthodox chaplains do for the Orthodox Church? Finally, I want to address the question of what Orthodox chaplains do for the Orthodox Church. I believe that Orthodox chaplaincy is one way for the Orthodox Church to make a difference to the greater communities in which they serve. Although chaplains aren't missionaries, and they certainly don't proselytize, they elicit curiosity by virtue of their compassion, understanding, and analysis of patient experience. We don't see things the way other Christian denominations do, or the way Jews, Muslims, or Buddhists do. And this is an important point. Every chaplaincy staff in a hospital is made up of many different faiths, and that's important because they all bring something to the mix. Every denomination is unique. We come from a tradition that is often regarded by the outside world as quaint, mysterious, picturesque, antiquated, or sexist, but it often isn't seen for the strength it gives to those who embrace it. The sheer practicality of Orthodox theology is a surprise to many patients. the fact that Orthodoxy assumes that there is cause for rejoicing in a fallen world, the very physical reality we find in the incarnation and resurrection, is a moving surprise to many. It leads people to ask who we are, where we come from, and to find out more. Chaplains are another way into the Orthodox Church. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'll be speaking today about women in the ministry of spiritual direction. So today I'll be sharing with you a glimpse into the process of spiritual direction as I have experienced it over many, many years. It's been one of the keys that has unlocked the closed doors of my inner world. My father, before dying, gave me these last words: Jane, which is my birth name, Jane, to thyself be true. That was a word of life from my father, who I grew up as the captain of the ship. He was military, and we grew up in a very, very controlled environment, to say the least. My personal experience of spiritual direction, I've lived for 40 years in monastic life, and it is from this background and perspective that I will talk about my own experience. My life's journey has taken me over a number of countries. I was born American, Roman Catholic, with military background, and living within the four corners of USA and abroad. For example, in Guam, Quebec, Hong Kong, Switzerland, France, to name most of them. My first experience of spiritual direction was during my 10 years teaching in Hong Kong. I profited immensely from meeting with a retired French bishop of Mongolia, truly a wise and holy person whose spiritual teaching and pastoral care have influenced me to this day. My second most important spiritual guide, a true spiritual mother, was the foundress and prioress of a monastery in southern France, where I was a member for 12 years. From its very beginnings, it found its roots in the early desert tradition, with a special focus on the apophthegmata, that is, the sayings of the desert, mothers and fathers, and the spiritual guidance correspondence of the Gaza elders by Sanufius and John. Now there, I was steeped into the liturgical and monastic spiritual life and practice of the Eastern Orthodox Church. After 5 years, the prioress asked me to participate in the spiritual formation of novices and retreatants. But I also remained accountable to her for my own personal journey as well as for my spiritual accompaniment of others. It's always difficult to express in words what I have received from these two spiritual guides. I not only benefited from their spiritual guidance, but I received invaluable teaching. I learned crucial importance of self-knowledge and discernment. It was an extraordinary gift to find elders or guides who are competent and willing to listen to disclosure of thoughts, logismi, to be able to lay before them my thoughts, feelings, and at times very painful crises. It was freeing, healing, and enlightening. But most of all, it deepened my awareness of the presence of God as a loving, as loving and compassionate, despite my own sense of unworthiness, but then also because of it. Spiritual awakening. Fast forward now to the present at Newskeet Monastery in Cambridge, New York. We frequently encounter people who are seriously questioning, who am I? What's my purpose in life? Why am I here? And I'll add that in the last 3 years, I can't believe the number of young people who are coming to the monastery with these questions and with the beginning of an awakening that they don't understand, and they feel like, what's wrong with me? I'm experiencing something that nobody else understands. Am I going crazy? When I listen to them, I often have the sense of them awakening to the mystery of God. I see and experience God as I listen to them. Metropolitan Callistos Ware comments on this becoming open to the transcendent. Quotation: the boundaries of the human person are extremely wide. Each of us knows very little about his or her true deep self. Through our faculties of perception, outward and inward, through our memory and through the power of the unconscious, we range widely over space. We stretch backward and forward in time, and we reach out beyond space and time into eternity. Within the heart are unfathomable depths, affirms St. Macarius. Unless there is such an initial awakening to grace, it is unlikely that anyone would desire spiritual direction. It's the beginning of a transforming power in one's life. In our Orthodox tradition, we call this awakening to the perception of God within, an invitation to what we long for most in this life: communion with God, theosis, deification. But incidentally, in so being awakened, that crack that Yona was speaking about, that's the crack where the light can come in. But this light at the beginning is full of joy and bliss and awe and wonder. But follows after that is all those areas, those dark areas that we need to own, of which look like dark shadows, but beneath the shadow is the light. We find ourselves caught up in controlling relationships, personal agendas, affirming our egos, and in fixating on the surface of life, often very much unaware of the subtle currents of the Holy Spirit within. All of this impels certain people to seek out a spiritual guide, and this existential tension can lead to metanoia, a profound, healthy re-examination of self, a change in mind and heart, and eventually in the way one is living. But it opens also the doors to listening to, how is the Holy Spirit leading me? Do I listen deeply to what I'm called to be called forth from within the experience? Now, how do I serve? I'm not called just to experience God and save my soul. No, every awakening is an awakening to the giving of self and to hearing those words, you feed them. So what is spiritual direction? Spiritual direction is quite simply a path enabling us to perceive and respond to the Holy Spirit in the depth of our being. One of my own teachers recently said, "My job as spiritual guide is to keep my students from tripping over the rocks in the road. As a student, though, my teacher keeps me from tripping over the rocks in the road." So my teachers help me to stay on the path. It's important to note that spiritual direction is not psychotherapy, although it might include elements of counseling. Spiritual direction does deal with the same raw material, so to speak, as with therapy, but the aim and the method are very different. Also, spiritual direction is not sacramental confession. Sacramental confession is more a process of looking back and expressing contrition before God, whereas we get to articulate our experiences and reveal our thoughts, logismoi, in the spiritual direction and bring to light how we are being invited to greater life. I'd like to move on now to a very important piece here, traps and abuses. There are many deceptions and dangers for those who wish to walk the spiritual path. Over the years, I have also encountered people who want spiritual directors to tell them what to do. They do not want to take responsibility for their own lives. It's easier to follow someone else's second-hand path than to do the hard work of forming a mature conscience and developing good judgment. Another a very serious abuse here. There are persons who have recourse to a spiritual director or an elder who has the need to control or is fascinated with power. This can infect any relationship. At present, we are hearing a good deal about pastoral abuse, especially in regards to women. This is one of the reasons that we need women as spiritual directors. Let's face it, there are false and incompetent guides out there. Persons seeking spiritual direction must also learn to discern and follow their own personal conscience and intuition and guidance of the Holy Spirit from within. Paul Evdokimov writes, "A spiritual director and directee both place themselves in the school of truth. There is no room for idolatry, even if this person seems like a saint." So what about training? Spiritual direction is now talked about very much here in America and across the religious spectrum. Should spiritual direction be taught in our colleges or seminaries? One suggestion would be to have classes on this topic whereby we familiarize ourselves with the writings on this subject, beginning with the writings of St. Anthony the Great, Amma Syncletica, continuing right up to the present day. Another suggestion would be to have some training in psychology and human development. However, it must be understood that studying about spiritual direction, even getting degrees, does not make one a spiritual director. It's a gift. Anyone engaged in the pastoral ministries, whether confessor or spiritual guide, must themselves be engaged in the spiritual path themselves. It means doing inner work on one's own passions, greed, lust, anger, vanity, pride. We need to grow in our own self-awareness and self-knowledge. As a guide, one must be guided, accountable, led, heard, and directed in this growth process. And last but not least, we must be persons of prayer, contemplation, meditation, communion with God, and a regular liturgical life and sacramental life. So in closing, I leave you with these reflections, hoping that more women will be hearing the call to engaging in this ministry of spiritual direction. I can assure you it is one of the most important and needed ones today that women engage in. The time does not allow me to give you many examples, but I think you have your own examples to fill out the spaces here. I pray that many more women become conscious of their God-given gifts and to serve actively in our churches, respective churches. But I do not think you will discover your gifts from within and the deep sense of being called that will allow you to stand up on our own two feet and claim these gifts and get the help from experienced people who've gone that road themselves. Thank you.
It's an honor and a privilege to be here today among fellow Orthodox, and above all for the particular purpose that we're here. For once, I'm not here to talk about my own scholarship. I'm happy to cede that to Valerie. But to offer what I do as an offering, as a service, in the hopes that it may be of use. I come from a background of service to one's church. I was raised an American Baptist in a family that could boast of ordained ministers on both my mother's and father's side. My father, too, was an ordained minister, and equally influential for my own religious formation, he was a seminary professor. And in fact, he did his master's degree here in the 1940s under Tillich and Niebuhr, and would have been in this chapel every day. I grew up in a household centered around church participation and involvement. I sang in the choir, served as altar server, attended retreats and summer camps. I was president of our youth group. My parents taught Sunday school. They taught fourth grade, and they served on multiple committees. My father remained centrally active in the church until his death in 1999. My mother, now 88, has only in the last couple months, because of her health, had to stop serving on church committees, and it grieves her deeply. Here, then, is what I learned from my parents and my family. One serves the church in every way that one can. I've never thought of Orthodoxy as a break from my past, but rather as a fulfillment of the faith that I have been learning as long as I have lived. My journey to Orthodoxy took some years. I became a catechumen formally in July 1985. And the following spring, on the Sunday of Mary of Egypt, I was received by chrismation at an OCA parish in Rochester, New York, where I was teaching at the university at the time. I attended services as often as they were held. The only other people who were there as often as me were the members of the choir, which, although it was a very small choir, was fantastic. The choir director, some of you may know him, was Mark Bailey, who directs the Yale Russian Chorus. And in many ways, he was a catechetical instructor for me. He, along with the priest, Father Cyril Stavrevsky, taught me Orthodoxy by teaching me the services. Thunderstruck by the beauty and power of liturgy, I felt also overwhelmed by how much I needed to learn. Because the choir was small, and wonderful and welcoming, and because I was always at the church, I began to sing with them. And ever since, I have found it almost impossible to locate myself anywhere else when I'm in church. In 1988, we moved to Rhode Island. Near our home was a welcoming Antiochian parish, St. Mary's in Pawtucket, led at that time by Father Timothy Ferguson. Soon I was in the chanter stand with several others, including several women, and in the choir loft, and also serving as epistle reader when there was need. On rare occasion, if there was a good reason, I also preached in evening services. During those early years in Rhode Island, Father Timothy, as my spiritual director, formed in me a deep commitment to understand my work as scholar and teacher within the secular academy as itself a vocation within the church. In 1989, following the Rhodes Conference on Women in the Orthodox Church, Father Timothy responded to the spirit of that meeting by inviting Metropolitan Philip Saliba to come to St. Mary's and to tonsor all four of us who were chanters at the time, two women, myself and Maureen Gorgigian, and two men who are both now retired. It was a glorious occasion and a humbling one, and one could not deny that something took place. The Metropolitan was there was a bishop there, there was an archpriest, there were two priests, there were three deacons, there was a subdeacon, they cut our hair, it happened. Some things from my upbringing have profoundly marked my Christian involvement for my whole life, and they provide the basis for what I here am calling the ministry of the Word, as I seek to enact it now in my Orthodox life. These correspond to the four ministries that are listed on your outline for my talk. What I call proclaiming and teaching, this is my commitment to serve a local parish with concrete involvements that utilize my skills. I mean, my particular skills happen to be that I teach. A deep love for the Bible, I call this the ministry of reading. A love of worship, the ministry of song. And a desire to put my education and training to the service of the church, and that I call the ministry of teaching. Let me say something about each of these. First, proclaiming and teaching. I was raised in a liberal Protestant tradition, so it never occurred to me that there would be any limitation on how I could serve the church. Part of what took so long in my journey to Orthodoxy, took years, was worry about what place there would be for me, not only as a non-ethnic convert, but further as a woman. What I appreciated very much, first at St. John's in Rochester and now for nearly 30 years at St. Mary's, has been the willingness of priests to let me provide service through the gifts I have and the openness of both parishes to women's liturgical participation in the forms of ministry that I have pursued, chanting, singing, reading the epistle, and sometimes teaching. Here then is the service that I offer, ministries of the Word, I offer in and through my parish. Not every priest and not every parish are open to such service. I have been very lucky and I've been grateful for this blessing. Secondly, the ministry of reading. Orthodoxy is blessed with services that are lavishly adorned with scripture. Readings abound from the Old Testament and the New. The Psalms accompany us at every turn. Biblical allusions, biblical cadence, biblical ornamentation carry us through each and every moment of the liturgy. I was fortunate to be raised in a household and in a religious community where I heard Bible read aloud often with reverence and majesty, and also with deep familiarity. I will always hear my father's voice in this particular way. He was a beautiful reader of scripture. I feel keenly the importance of offering the word of the words in liturgical practice. Bible must be offered. It must be read aloud in liturgy in ways that serve to bring it home to the congregation, to make the words their own, to make the words heard and known and lived. Reading the psalms and lections of matins and vespers and reading the epistle in the divine liturgy are acts of important ministry. It is always hard when someone reads awkwardly or stumbles over the words of the Bible as if they are something foreign or strange, or when someone whips through the psalms so quickly one can barely catch the sense. This seems to me a particular hazard of young seminarians, I think. I've always loved this form of ministry, reading, because it is also a way for the reader, and this is myself, to attend more closely to the words of the Bible, to take them into heart and mind, and to savor their richness. The ministry of song. I grew up singing in a church choir, and I found myself there from the start of my Orthodox life. When I first began to attend Orthodox services, I was overwhelmed by the sheer enormity of liturgy. So many words to hear, so much to try to grasp and understand. And most of those words were sung, so they kind of slide by, you know, in a wondrous cascade of melodies and tones. I could never keep up. I began to sing with the choir as a convert, first of all, because it helped me follow the services, helped me follow the words. Singing allowed me to focus on the services no matter their length. It covered my weariness. It enabled me to lay aside all earthly cares. It enabled me to memorize whole chunks of liturgy, whether litanies, hymns, troparia, responses, or prayers. I could carry the liturgy with me wherever I went, whatever I was doing, and I still do. I never enter the classroom to teach without chanting the Troparia in Tome 3 from Resurrection Matins, "Say among the heathen that the Lord reigneth." I do this for a living. I speak among the heathen. That's my job. You know, sing that going into class. I entered the chanter's stand originally for the same reason. There were not enough people to chant, so it was a way to help. And it was also a way for me to learn. As with reading scripture or singing in the choir, it was a way to offer to the congregation a ministry of the word of the words, of the words of the word, to offer with reverence and clarity these words which teach and guide and lead us. I am one of very few Orthodox women privileged to be a tonsured chanter. Are there any others here? In the 25 years since my tonsuring took place, I have often reflected on the meaning of that act. I've done my best to make that tonsuring mean something in my own life, and certainly to take seriously the responsibilities of serving in the chanter's stand, to do the services well, or as well as I can, in an ordered and careful way. Some things I do better than others. I know well Tome 9, I'll tell you. But I take very seriously that this is a responsibility, an office that I was given, and to which I am consecrated. Over the years, this awareness has affected me in different ways. There have been occasional periods when I have considered leaving the chanter stand. But in a fundamental sense, I do not feel it can be my choice to do so. I was tonsured to this service. In some very real sense, it is not mine to stop or give away. It is a responsibility I must fulfill. What else could that act of tonsuring have meant? On the other hand, I must say frankly that I don't think it matters to anyone else. I don't think it matters to my parish, who like me chanting but don't remember that this happened, I think, and 25 years later, a lot of the parish has changed. More painfully, I don't think it matters to the larger church. To my knowledge, no one was tonsured after us. The church has not done anything with the tonsuring that was performed at my church that I can see. Many women and men are chanters who are not tonsured. It's as if it never happened. But it happened. And it is a blessing that I carry with me every day. It is a service that I will continue to fulfill as long as I am able. And finally, the ministry of teaching. As it happens, my training and profession involve teaching and research in the history of Christianity, with a particular focus on Byzantine and Syriac traditions. Thus, a particular grace I know in my life is the constant intersection of my work and also my life in the church. I'm glad when I can put my knowledge to the service of the church. On occasion, I have preached or spoken at St. Vladimir's or Holy Cross seminaries, or served the archdiocese with my scholarship. It always means a great deal to me when that happens. Finally, I need to end with a comment on the voices of liturgy and why women's voices matter in liturgy. When I enter an Orthodox church without women's voices, hearing only the voices of male clergy, I am invariably startled. It sounds hollow, pale, and partial to my ears. It sounds to me as if the whole of the laity are silenced in that partial sound. The congregation feels like an audience, passively watching and listening, but not participating in the worship being offered. Surely our hope is to cultivate deep and vibrant participation among the faithful for the life and health of our churches and of our church. Acknowledging that women have ministries to offer, and in fact are already offering them, is a critical step in bringing that hope to fruition. Naming these ministries for what they are, sacred offerings to God, worthy of consecrated service, is also a demonstration that the church, no less than God's own self, values these offerings. Such respect and valuation then become, or could become, part of parish life, of the laity's own awareness and participation, and indeed of the clergy's awareness and appreciation for the full congregation. It would thereby magnify all our attitudes toward service. I cannot end without one very short, one paragraph, reflection from my own scholarship, which, after all, is the real thing that I do. It was a unique feature of the ancient Syriac Christians to have consecrated women's choirs from the early 4th century onwards. And to this day, women's choirs are, although the consecration part somehow disappears around the 12th century, they're still very much a part of that life. According to early Syriac canon law, every village, town, and city must have a women's choir to sing the morning and evening services, Sunday liturgy, and the feast days. These were not choirs of nuns, but women consecrated to a musical ministry. Syriac church canons mandated that these choirs must sing the doctrinal hymns of the church that provided holy instruction for all the faithful. For many centuries, probably till at least the 10th, the choir directors were deaconesses. These choirs remain a living practice for Syriac churches to this day. Among the Syriac fathers, those like St. Ephrem the Syrian and St. Jacob of Sarug commented on these women's choirs. St. Jacob was a preacher, poet, and bishop of the 6th century. He argued, this is St. Jacob, St. Ephrem is a paper of himself. Jacob argued that the sound of women's choirs in the liturgy was important for two reasons. First, because the women's choirs led the congregation in singing the responses and the refrains in the hymns. They provided model and means for active lay participation in the liturgy in very practical terms. Secondly, and this is my favorite part, Jacob argued that the sound of women's choirs, not even the words they sang, the sound of the women's voices in the liturgy was the constant reminder that salvation had indeed come for all people, not only for Adam, but for Eve, not only for men, but for women. If St. Ephrem knew this in the 4th century and St. Jacob knew it in the 6th century, shouldn't we also know it in the 21st? Did we forget? I think of this often. Women's voices matter in the church's liturgical life. They are the constant and necessary offering to complete the liturgy, the work of the people, as a true and whole offering to God. Without them, the work of liturgy is incomplete. It is our grace, our blessing, and our obligation to offer that completion. We can do so in the ministry of the word, and the church has the power to name this as ministry and to consecrate it as such. Thank you.
A little bit about philanthropic outreach. I think that that will be very relevant. My parents live with my husband and me. They have lived with us for about 11 years now. As a result, I write a blog, a caregiving blog, whenyourparentsmovein.com. I also write for agingcare.com as a blogger. I think that that experience is very, very relevant when we're talking about philanthropic outreach and the work of the deaconess. The parish I've attended since 1986 is located in the state capital. It is near a major university with 50,000 students. The parish is vibrant and alive with children, young adults, the middle-aged, the elderly. The parish attracts converts who bring their friends who then become converts. A thriving outreach program has been established and operated for about a decade in our urban, low socioeconomic neighborhood. This philanthropic outreach program has been life-changing, not just to the neighborhood, but to those of us who chose to minister, to feed the poor, the hungry, and the infirm face-to-face. In the 80s, however, my parish was still in mission status, and my parish priest was a full-time teacher. He needed help. More importantly, he wanted help. He understood the gifts that could be found in sharing his ministry. I was a young mother at the time, having just turned 30. Father asked me to be the parish council president. I agreed. That single event catapulted both our parish and me into territories in which we never had been before nor anticipated. For the past several weeks now, and in preparing my paper, I've considered how my ministry could have made a difference if I had been an ordained deaconess, a position, by the way, that does not and should not lead to the priesthood in any way. Here's what my experience has taught me. An ordained person brings theologically sound proposals, thinking, and discussion to the planning and administration and implementation in the parish. When that is coupled with feminine gifts, there's an order and balance that allows God to work fully. The ordained female can address certain needs and issues affecting women and children in a way that an ordained male cannot, simply by virtue of gender. God gave us differing gifts that we see exemplified in families, for example. The parish is a family, also requiring the different gifts of both male and female. With a theological education and an ordination, the deaconess possesses formal authority to collaborate with the hierarch and the priest, and even to make some decisions on her own. An ordained female would help address the practical issues of parish education, communications, choir music, management, and preparation of the liturgical cycle. She could help with finances and outreach. With her theological training and ordination, she would approach these tasks with right thinking, without the need for hand-holding by the priest in every instance. Thirteen different duties of the deaconess can be identified, 13 duties, found in two main sources, the study of liturgy and ordination rites of the ancient churches of East and West, identify tasks including administration, supervision at liturgy, taking charge of properties, reporting to the bishop, providing pastoral care to women, sheltering guests, and many more. Now, along with that, let's consider the philanthropic opportunities that that deaconess could provide. I mentioned earlier that our parish implemented a rather unique neighborhood outreach program. We're deliberately located near the Ohio State University campus for the purpose of serving Orthodox students there. Our neighborhood, however, and we did not plan this, our neighborhood is made up of many low-income households. In the early years of our time there, men and women would come to our door asking for assistance. Inexperienced and torn, both the laity and the clergy, inexperienced and torn between what felt comfortable to us and our fundamental Christian understanding of helping the poor, we stumbled, we made mistakes, we were frightened, we frightened parishioners away who did not want to come in contact with those with mental illnesses, addictions, the poor. These were tough times. Father and I spent countless hours talking about what we could do. What should we do? How do we keep people from leaving the church who did not feel comfortable? How do we oppose those who wanted to move the church to a safer neighborhood? We were steadfast. Someone from the parish came forward with the absolute characteristics needed to face our challenges head on. It was not a female, it was a male. That's okay. He knew boundaries. He knew that a mere handout would do no one any good. This was the beginning of a neighborhood outreach program that has evolved with his expertise, with God's guidance. This neighborhood outreach program has evolved to offer several meals a week, the teaching of skills and responsibility, raising self-esteem, and loving interaction between the neighborhood folks and parishioners. On Holy Saturday, it is these very neighborhood people, those afflicted with the demons, the addictions, the poverty, they're the ones who stand guard in our street as we process with the Lord's body. Can you imagine the impact a deaconess could have in this particular situation? Not to mention those opportunities in your neighborhoods, regardless of where they're located, in ministering to those mothers, children, and families. In her paper called The Benevolent Tradition, The Charity of Women, Karen Halverson states this, and I quote, "Through sacrifice, mercy, and charity, women down through church history may have given us our greatest examples of love demonstrated and proven through selfless giving and service to others," end of quote. Scripture is full of examples of women as bearers of philanthropic outreach and charitable giving. Philanthropy is at the heart of the Christian faith, and women, with their God-given nature to be sensitive to the needs of others, can help philanthropy spread to the nooks and crannies of this world where it's so desperately needed. Halverson also says, and I quote, "Two of the five basic offices established in Acts and the epistles were made up of women, widows and deaconesses. Both were ministries of charitable service. Leadership was maintained through service. Paul, we know, describes Phoebe, a deaconess. He describes her as a deaconess as, and I'm probably not pronouncing this correctly, prostasis, which means a female guardian, a protector. In its technical usage, this term referred to a legal representative of strangers who were deprived of civil rights, or to a patron. Phoebe, and I quote, a helper of many and of me, Paul, as well, from Romans 16:22, apparently provided financial aid and possibly legal assistance. John Chrysippus speaks about the deacon and deaconess sharing the same duties in his book titled Remembering and Reclaiming the Diaconia. And I quote, throughout the present study, the deliberate focus is on the development of the ordained male diaconate in the early church and contemporary practice. However, all that is said about the role and function of male deacons is largely applicable also to female deacons. Indeed, in scriptural and patristic literature alike, the Greek word diakonos can denote either a male or a female deacon. In essence, and what we've learned also here today, is what the male deacon did for the men, the female deacon did for the women. So what then does an ordained role bring? First, accountability, and secondly, order. Accountability, there's a difference when somebody's ordained. Think about the difference between your parish priest and a layperson visiting you in the hospital, for example. The layperson may be the most pious person in your parish. The difference is that ordination leads to a greater and far different level of obedience and accountability. As for order, the presence of women in the administration of the church is currently absent. The current administration of the church does not reflect what I believe is the full intention of Christ, that when he spoke to the Samaritan woman, when he healed the woman's flow of blood, when the myrrh-bearing women were the first to hear of Christ's resurrection and ran to tell the apostles. But let's not stop there. The ordained role allows us to officially recognize and put to work the gifts and talents of all God's people. Why would we ignore 50% of the talents and gifts God gives to us by not setting us aside with ordination so we can fully minister in an accountable and credible manner? You may argue that women carrying out God's work as lay ministers should and continue to do so. We're all called to be ministers, of course. But how could an ordained deaconess make a difference in the life of the parish? The presence, as I said before, of women in the administration of the church on our ordained level reflects Christ's intention for his church. I use my own experiences to illustrate how ordination can possibly make that difference. As a deaconess charged with parish administration, I could use my God-given feminine talents and gifts to help my priest in the administration of the church in a much more theologically based manner. I'd have that theological blessing, background and blessing of ordination to help me with planning, decisions, executing on that administrative level. For the women and men I came into contact with or ministered to, their perceptions of me would be different. They'd know that I worked through the bishop's blessing and that I possessed a theological understanding in which I used to carry out those duties and complement the parish priest. I would help the priest by visiting the sick women and children of the parish, teaching the faith, providing counsel to the new parent, the new wife, the struggling wife, the overwhelmed mother, the burned out caregiver, the dying. Parishioners would know I would protect their privacy and minister to them in confidentiality. I would be able to help prepare catechumens and newcomers with classes and instruction. I could assist with baptisms by meeting with parents and godparents, counseling, even participating in part of the baptismal service. I could minister to the families, mothers, and children of not only our parish, but our neighborhood. I could do all of this using my unique gifts as a woman. I'm convinced after 20 years of serving in an administrative role for my beloved church, that a deaconess can provide much-needed service to the parish priest, the women, children of the parish, the surrounding community, and the church itself. She can offer the gifts and talents given to her by God to use for His glory and for His people. She reflects the fullness of the church as Christ intended. She brings order, obedience, and accountability to the community. She is the Samaritan woman, the woman with the flow of blood, the myrrh-bearing woman. She is St. Phoebe, the deaconess. Thank you.
Thank you all to our panelists. We have a slight change in the program because we are very fortunate today to have with us Paulina Pettis. She's a sophomore at Murray School in Washington, D.C., and who also attends St. Sophia Greek Orthodox Cathedral in their capital. The Greek Orthodox Archdiocese holds an annual competition each year called the Artorical Festival, where students are asked to speak about set religious topics. And the best speakers at the parish level move to the regionals and their diocese, and then on to the national competition. And last year, Paulina won second place in the regional level with the speech that she's going to give to us today. The topic of her speech was, as St. Paul writes, and I quote, "God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your strength," unquote, from 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. What are some times in your life in which you have experienced the truthfulness of St. Paul's statement? Paulina, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
First of all, I would just like to say thank you to the St. Phoebe Center for inviting me to participate in this historic event, and to the Union Theological Seminary for hosting the conference. I am ecstatic to be here and to know so many care about the role of women in deacon ministry in our church. Last year, I took part in the St. John Chrysostom Oratorical Festival. I chose the topic where St. Paul writes, "God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your strength," in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. I will now share with you that speech. Imagine the scorching sun blazing upon the shifting sand. With temperatures soaring past 140 degrees, the sand is harsh, unforgiving, and infertile. Stretching out into the distance, the desert is empty and endless, giving no food, no water, and no shelter. It is a never-ending purgatory of sand and sky. I was in that desert when I started to question my Orthodox faith. I learned that because I'm a girl, my role in the church would be different from what I thought. 2 years ago, my brother became an altar boy and had a great spiritual learning experience. With my education in Sunday school and my growing love of my religion, it hurt my soul to know that I could never serve in the altar just because I'm a girl. I cried countless Sunday nights. I wanted to know why girls could not serve in the altar. My parents and grandparents could not provide me with adequate answers. All of a sudden, I had entered uncharted territory. There was a rift between me and my faith. As I lost hope in my faith, my focus drifted from God's world to the material world. It was a dark time. I did not want to go to the church I loved anymore. I felt left out. I learned from my Catholic and Episcopal girlfriends that they served on their altars, so I asked my parents if we could join their churches. Despite my temptation, the Theotokos gave me strength, and I had an epiphany that I did not need to leave my church. For it was not the whole Orthodox religion that was causing me angst. It was just this one area. I already had Christ's love. What I needed was my church's support. I wrote my parish priest a letter. When we met, Father Steve helped restore my faith. He reminded me that historically, from Mary Magdalene to the many female saints, women have played important roles in the church, and that girls like me can too participate. St. Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, "God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your strength," rang true. I was tempted to take the easy way out by joining another church, but with the help of my priest and remembering Christ's example of battling the devil in the desert, I found the strength to focus on Christ's love. What I learned was that I do have a voice, and that it's okay to tell people how you feel. I realized that in its simplest forms, the church values all its members equally, whether you're a woman, man, girl, or boy. As stated in Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Perhaps the modern Greek Orthodox Church is listening to St. Paul, as I discovered that our church recently commissioned its first institutional chaplain, a woman, here in the USA, and that the church does not prohibit girls from the altar. In fact, the possibility of deaconesses returning to the church has been discussed and is still being discussed. Such great hopeful movements, coupled with more traditional roles for girls, such as singing in the choir, volunteering in the Philoptichos, participating in oratorical festivals, teaching in Sunday school, and becoming nuns, should inspire us all to be active in our faith. Overall, it's important for girls and women of the Greek Orthodox faith to keep in mind that we do have a voice, and it should not go unheard. I was silent in the desert, as many of us have been. I'm no longer in that desert. And through my experience, I ascertained that when one keeps Christ's love in their heart, they will always have the strength to conquer any desert that they may face. Thank you.